Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and as always, I am joined by the magnificent JP. How are you doing today, JP?
Very good. I actually just got back from a tour of a house that I was kind of not really looking at for my job, kind of a thing.
Oh, wait. Okay. So let me just back to up. Recap. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's back up.
Okay. My name is JP. I work for a company called Open Listings. We make the home buying process a lot easier. And that's my 3-second plug. But specifically, I work on like everything that deals with a user visiting a house. So if you looked at our feed and you were like, ooh, I like this house in Santa Barbara or whatever it is you live. I don't know if we're in Santa Barbara. Let me give a better example.
Yeah, you are actually.
We are. Okay, cool. Yeah. Wow. I don't even know where our agents are. Okay, let's say I want to find a house in Santa Barbara. We have like MLS listings that pull houses from Santa Barbara. And I'm like, ooh, I want to look at this house. I can go ahead and I can schedule a tour and I can go on a tour just like without ever having to like talk to an agent personally. You might like text them to like sync up to make sure that you're going at the right times, but it's all on the app and that's all very cool. And you can go on a tour. You could go see a house, take 10, 15 minutes out of your day and that's it.
That's so much more convenient than the traditional way of like having to call and leave messages and play phone tag and try to book a showing. Ugh.
That's funny that you said showing and not tour because we're like trying to change all of our language and our ubiquitous language from showing to tour.
Huh. Interesting.
Which is weird because it's like a natural thing to say showing, right? Or like, but it's also natural to say tour depending on the context that you're talking about it in.
Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like that's kind of what I know of the industry says, but I never use the word showing in like any other context. So you guys are probably onto something with saying tour. But yeah. Anyway, so you actually like used your app as a user and kind of dog fooded your app today and you went and did a home tour.
Yeah. I checked out a place in Silver Lake. I wanted to check out places in like actually in downtown Los Angeles because there's like some cool like one bedroom condos that I'm actually like playing with the idea of maybe looking at. I don't know, just for fun. We'll see. But I don't have that much time today and I didn't want to have to deal with like whatever the parking situation looks like in downtown Los Angeles. So I was like, ah, screw it. I'll take a look at this house in like Silver Lake. No, sorry. Los Feliz. It was like a 2-bedroom condo in Los Feliz, which is really cool. It's like always cool to be using the products that you're working on as like an actual user. It gives you like real insight to be able to step into a user's shoes and like actually get real empathy for the products that you're building and the problems that you're trying to solve. So that was really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you are a software developer out there, I strongly recommend that you try to do that. I mean, at minimum once a quarter, like really try to look at your product with fresh eyes, go through the product flow from start to finish. And this is beyond like the regular QA and checking things out. Like really try to put your mind and the eyes of a new user and go through it with fresh eyes. And just, I love opportunities when I have to use tech products in my life that are kind of ancillary or I can pick up patterns from what I, so like this week, I had never used before this app WAG to like get your dog walked.
Oh, the dog thing, yeah.
Yeah, the dog walking thing. And so basically it's like, it's a peer-to-peer thing where you put out a request and then people in your neighborhood will come and walk your dog for you. And it's so funny. Like I never have needed this in the past. My wife is out of town and I couldn't be home for like 10 hours. I'm like, dude, my dog needs to go on a walk. So I did it. And it was, I love that opportunity to like fresh download an app, create an account, onboard. And like, I actually had notes open and was taking notes of what they did good and bad and try to think really critically about it. And I think there's a lot to that, like going through something with a critical eye and trying to learn from those experiences as much as possible. And there was just a lot of, and there's actually that website, it's like user onboarding, that should be my pick later.
Usertesting.com?
No, I'll save my pick. It's a really good one. We'll talk about that one later. Okay, so cool. Anyway, that's awesome. And then this week, JP, you've got something exciting coming up. You're heading up to San Francisco, right, for the week?
Oh, yeah, totally. In fact, I need to leave in like 3 hours to Burbank Airport. So we're doing like a company week-long hackathon where we get to work on stuff outside of the normal sprint. So I'm going up to the Open Door office in San Francisco. It's going to be super fun. I think 7 people are coming down from San Francisco to our LA office. I think it's like 6 engineers and 1 designer, I think. I don't know. Ever since like it was known that we have this like LA office now that we got like acquired or we like merged, everyone, not everyone, but there's like a lot of interest from people in San Francisco that are like, I want to move to LA and like relocate. So I don't know, maybe grass is always greener because there's definitely people that are like, oh man, San Francisco sure sounds pretty good.
That sounds awesome. So that'll be cool to kind of step away from your day-to-day job and just like focus on a project with kind of a new and the same group of people. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So I'm looking forward to that for you and looking forward to hearing about it when you come back and like what that experience was like an in-house hackathon thing, what that was like. So yeah. We are currently powering through this short reader by Avdi Grimm, and it's called Exceptional Ruby, and it's a book all about writing software with failure in mind. So I do want to like keep hearing about current projects and things, but I also want to cover a little bit of the meat of what we've got from our book this week. And so, and I actually have a kind of embarrassing, I don't even know if I mentioned this story last week about the downtime in production regarding a rescue clause, but we can talk about that a little bit.
I don't think we did. We'll get into it later.
I don't think I mentioned that. Ugh. Okay. So we'll talk through that as well, because it's a perfect takeaway for how to, you know, design software with failures in mind. So we can use my failure and embarrassment to try to teach others.
Sweet. Yeah. So the chapter, or it's not really a chapter, but the section for this book is called Responding to Failures. So this is, hopefully this section will be more actionable. So we'll have like action items that you can possibly take away from this so that like, it's one thing to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to consider some failures, but like, what do you actually do when mm-hmm. your code fails? So yeah, that's what we'll get into.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my biggest takeaways from the section and kind of inherent in the lesson that I learned this week is just the concept of failing as early as possible, failing by the source and where the source is. And I know that was kind of a side note in the section. It's not necessarily about responding, but you know, within this context of how to respond to errors, it was talking about how the last thing you want to do when you have an exception raised or an error within your code is to pass that along throughout your code and then have unexpected results. So just to avoid any more like tension on what the story is, let me just break into the story real quick. So I build a mobile app. It's a web app and mobile app for health coaching. I've mentioned in the past where, you know, there's health coaches and then people trying to get healthy on the other end, and there's these chat interfaces. And so it's heavily augmented with SMS. So from a health coach's standpoint, you have this like nice Facebook style messenger interface on your web app screen, and you're sending messages back and forth via SMS. And so the users on the other end are just interacting with via SMS. So we had a bug that was live for 3 days that the health coaches would create a message in the interface. The message would successfully create in the interface. So like the in-app message would create in the web app, mm-hmm. and no failures would surface of any kind, but there was actually no SMS going out to users.
Interesting.
And it was 3 solid days that there was it from the end coaches, the admins in the inside, they would have no idea that these SMSs weren't sending. And so what I noticed in our logs and our error logs, and we'll look at that in a little bit. It wasn't our error logs, actually, it was performance logs. I was looking at how much our reply rate dropped, because we kind of, that's one of the metrics that we have in our app, is we try to keep our reply rate really high because it means we're doing a really good job of engaging users. And the reply rate went way down for like 3 days. So I started pulling the threads of like, why aren't people responding? And then I was looking through our logs and like, we have so many messages going out. I'm seeing them here. And then it wasn't until I actually hopped all the way over to Twilio that I saw that the messages weren't actually sending and noticed the discrepancy between what went out this week on our servers versus Twilio's servers. So this was an error in production that pushed that far. It went through staging. So we actually have a staging server where we tested the SMS. We tested the SMS, it sent all the way through to production, and it didn't pass along the error. So the hugest takeaway for me in this is, and the reason for the bug, so let me go to the reason for the bug was, there was a check for the environment that responds a little bit differently because we have like test numbers. So in development, in testing, and in our staging environment, we use these 555 numbers like in the movie. So like 555-728-55555 or whatever. And there is a small line of code that checks for the environment. If it's in those environment, it lets those be valid numbers to do testing, because otherwise there's not really any way to pass data along and check for it, because we can't send those 555 values in live. And as well, like in our tests, when we run our tests or in staging, we don't want SMSs sending out constantly, because every time you'd run a test suite, you'd send out 5 dozen texts as those tests run. So In order to do that, we do some a little bit of mocking and checking with these test number checks. But what happened is there was a if Rails environment staging or if it is production, but it didn't ever check for production. And so basically what ended up happening is it passed through the method with a success without ever actually passing the SMS message into production. So that was one of the issues. And then the second issue was that we had an error with further down that chain. So after that check was fixed, then there was still a bug actually. And so this is one of those instances where it was really difficult to try to write tests that replicate it because the real world replication is an SMS going out, which you can't do in console. You can't send out 5 dozen SMSs in console and have that test run reliably and performant and have your Twilio cost be down, because otherwise every time you're running your tests and CI and everywhere else. So as a result, you have to mock this. So there was an error within our mock that didn't match the actual production code that allowed an invalid number to be passed. And ultimately, there was a rescue block. So we had a rescue block there, but the rescue block simply puts out to AppSignal. So we knew that there was something up, and then it just returned true, but then it just carried through. So to the end user, there was no potential issue. And I think I didn't maybe explain this all in the best, but here is the main takeaways of how we fixed it and how this relates to it. So the first thing is that because the rescue block simply returned true, it passed that error along the system without any error actually rendering out into production. So it looked like it was completely valid to the end user. So the first takeaway is handle your rescue blocks in a way that makes sense, or worst case, don't have one. Because if we didn't have a rescue block, it would have returned a 500 error. And in this case, I would have way rather returned a 500 error. And that kind of goes back to what the section was talking about failing early. Failing as early as you can in the code and not passing along those variables. So I'll stop ranting for now.
Dang. No, that was a very good story. I like digested all of that. I have a couple follow-up questions. What exactly was failing with Twilio? Was it trying to send the text message, but it wasn't, so it stopped trying? Because I'm sure there's like some kind of mechanism.
So there was two bugs introduced, and it was working in staging because the staging server only uses test numbers, which don't ever actually pass to the Twilio methods.
Right.
And so what was happening is in production, we were attempting to pass real numbers, but there was a second bug below that guard clause that catched whether or not it was in production or local. So there was a guard clause, but if you were in production, it went past the guard clause, but there was actually a second bug. There was two bugs.
Oh, okay.
So once it passed the guard clause, it was actually, we instantiated a variable and then there was a typo in the second variable. Mm. So it was passing a nil number in production. But it wasn't passing the nil number in staging because it actually worked to send the test numbers.
Okay, that makes sense. Wow, okay.
But here's the worst part. We were passing a nil value into a method, but for some reason in the block of code, we used an instance variable. So we said at send to number, and then we passed through at send number. So we just missed the two in naming the variables. I didn't catch it in code review. And like I said, because the development and staging environments don't actually run this block, it wasn't caught. But the main issue here now is that because it was an instance variable, it simply returned nil instead of no method. So if we would have just not put the at sign and just used a local variable, it would have blown up, which would have been good. We would have wanted it to fail. And then the rescue block would have fired and we would have seen the app signal failure. But it was even worse because it didn't even run that block.
Okay. Wow.
So it was like so many stages on this bug and of catching it and how like it actually was fixed that it was such a nightmare.
Okay. So now I have a question for you. How do you think you should handle a scenario like that? Like, do you make it so that the message doesn't post? Like it doesn't persist to the database and like the little chat feature you have? Or should it persist and then you have like a cron that tries to like send out all of the unsent messages?
you know, it's a really good opportunity to deal with failure, and we haven't yet solved it 100%. So this is, of course, we responded to the bug, fixed the bug, and got it live in production. And so as of right now, I made sure that if we're passing bad values or a bad number or there's an issue with Twilio, like I went and I broke the Twilio API key to test it to make sure that it couldn't connect to Twilio and saw what would happen. Mm-hmm. So right now, it'll refresh, reload the page, put up a banner that says, I'm sorry, something went wrong. And it sends something over to AppSignal. So at least right now, it lets the user know, it doesn't create the message, and it lets us know in AppSignal. So for now, that's how it's fixed. And I've actually been consulting with a developer who's a lot more experienced and working a lot higher scale, because this product I'm managing is frankly beyond my experience. It's pushing me a little bit, which is good. And the people I'm working with know that, and they want to grow with me, and it's really exciting. But we brought in a consultant to just consult on how to solve this issue. And we've identified a couple of paths forward, and some I'm more excited to pursue than others. But one is encapsulating this messaging create action into a messaging service that not only handles the sending of the message, verifies that it's sent, and then persists the message to the database, which is one way to go about it. So if it fails in any stage, then the message isn't persisted to the database. We haven't yet gone down that path. The first place we're starting right now is getting really good mocks in place that actually, so in every setting, all blocks of code run. And that's the biggest thing that I've learned in this process, is you should really never, ever check for an environment in a model or in a block of code like that. You should be doing that at a higher level and actually mocking. And this is a whole, could be a whole episode in itself, like mocking and those types of things. But basically, now all of what the current pull request that we're reviewing, kind of thinking about a solution, is every line of code in that message model always runs regardless of the environment, but it's inheriting from different mocks. But if you think about it, it's really the same thing. You're still switching on environment. You're still running different versions of your code. So technically, you could still run into some of these problems. And so I really like the idea of either of switching it. So right now, how it's created is the database line is created, then the message sends. I like the idea of first sending the message and then creating the item in the database, or somehow, if that's not performant, somehow checking that the message was actually created and then surface that as an issue. But you know, there's a lot of ways forward here, and we haven't thought of the best one. And because it was such a critical downtime, it's really tempting to like want to spin up an SMS testing service of our own, where it's like we buy 3 Twilio numbers, put some hot words, and have them message each other every midnight at night, because it was such a critical downtime for our application. Like, it was really hard to be down like that. But it's like, there's probably a more elegant way to solve this, but it's a really hard thing to test, because if you're not actually sending data down carriers' pipes, like over T-Mobile's networks or through like the infrastructure, you're not really testing your code.
Yeah.
That's what's so hard about this issue.
Yeah, and for example, like the way that Sprint receives messages from Twilio is like it breaks it up into like 4 different text messages. Like, you know, there's just things you can't really account for.
Yeah.
This is such an interesting problem, because now you're talking about like sync issues. Because like, when do you persist the message to the database? Do you persist the message to the database? Should you persist it anyways and then have like a cron that delivers all the unsent messages, so that like the user experience like sends the message, but you don't really necessarily want to send the message and then send the SMS later, because like the two are like tied together, right? So it's like you don't want like it to send in the future because you think you're sending it now. They do need to be sent at the same time. I don't know. Very, very interesting problem to have.
But if you look at this problem from the lens of this book we're going through right now, and so it's very, very timely, is that if there was proper exception handling within that block of sending that message, and you sent the message before persisting the message object to the database, because there's kind of two things here. There's an in-app message that represents like what's on our database, and then there's the SMS that sends as a representation of what's, you know, in the database here. So it's kind of Airbnb style the way they do that. And so there is a sync issue here, but in reality, if you were to properly interact with the API with proper error handling, maybe even do a retry if there was an issue, which what we talked about last week, and then only if it was successful, persist that object to the database, it would fully solve this problem. Although it wouldn't necessarily solve the whole like more tooling problem of how to test the code in what context without actually sending out messages. But yeah, it's really interesting that like there's all these tools like Litmus and like Mailtrap and a couple others that are just for email testing, where they give you an email address and then like they'll give you reports on whether or not those emails are delivering and what those rates are. There is no product out there for SMS testing like this. And so it like makes my brain think like, ooh, I wonder
open
if I
source.
Could, yeah, open source it or spin something up or get something going. But I'm pretty sure that if you can think a lot more intelligently about your mocks and trust your mocks more, that's the way forward. Because if you think about like testing an AWS integration, you're not going to make your own fake AWS.
No,
you're going to rely on a library that stubs it, that quote unquote mocks it out. So why in this case would it make sense to build out a whole SMS interface? But at the same time, we've done that with email. We don't stub email. We actually like quasi send email oftentimes in staging.
Yeah, sometimes.
So it's, yeah, because it relies on these other pipes that you don't have control of. So I think there might be an argument for testing this in that context. But anyway, back to kind of the content of what we're talking about of error handling and how to approach this. But I love this example because it was very painful and that's when lessons stick for me. But I love it too because there's so much that this specific book is addressing that would help us kind of break down that problem and solve it. So the other one is it's talking about remote failure reporting was one of the things I highlighted in the book this week, which is kind of what I've been saying over and over as I've said, like AppSignal, which people use Bugsnag, people use Rollbar, people use all these different services that do this, but it's a really good practice to in rescue blocks or in failures to pass those messages to some kind of central repository. And there was a section in the book about this. And there is just so many benefits to doing this because, you know, on everything that I manage, every time a user experiences an error, if I've designed the system properly, in theory, I should have an email the second that user sees that 500 page. The second that user has that error that they're experiencing, we have an email, we have it logged in a database, we know what users are seeing it, when they're seeing it. That allows our customer service teams to be able to follow up with individual users that experience problems, ask more questions, get more background, and just like solve it with a sense of A, confidence, and B, with a sense of just calm. You can approach it, like you can come into work in the morning, know that five users experienced this specific error, know exactly where they saw it, and approach it instead of just like getting that text of just like, something's wrong, something's blowing up, and not being able to recreate it. It's amazing though how many independent devs I talk to out there that are kind of in this like, you know, building MVPs and getting startups going, like, that don't use these services. And to me, it's an absolute essential if you're managing any scale, even if it's 30, 40 users, anytime someone's depending on your product, it's so cheap and easy to toss in your project. It's insane to not do it. It's like writing code without version control. And people do this like, oh, I only ever commit to master. I don't even write commits. I just kind of push. It's like, dude, like make branches, like have a change history that makes sense, right?
Yeah. Something you touched upon earlier, actually, I thought was interesting that I sort of want to revisit is, you actually noticed this bug because of your metrics. Like, oh, how come our conversion rates just like dropped all of a sudden? And so like AppSignal lets you like also see, you can, I'm sure it has a thing where you can like track different metrics too. Like if a user clicked this button, it will like track that. And then you could probably pass in like a user ID or something. And then I'm sure you can create like graphs and stuff like that. I know Amplitude is basically like that.
More so than AppSignal is. And I probably misspoke because we have an admin console that shows us those numbers.
Oh, okay.
So I think I misspoke there possibly when I was saying. So when I was seeing the response rate, that was in our native.
Oh, okay.
That was in our native dashboard. So I apologize if I misspoke. Yeah, but for clarity there, we have our own, which is also really important to just kind of understand your users and what they're doing on their platform, whether that's your own tooling or these other tools like you talked about that allow you to spin that up. But so like one of our key metrics for success that I'm defining my job by, and that's another great thing as a developer to have, like, what is success in your role? So one of these key metrics that I'm trying to drive is this SMS response rate. And so that's using smart automation, a little bit of not really machine learning. I won't bullshit you guys. You know, it's smart algorithms. Yeah, smart algorithms that are following up. We're not yet in machine learning. We hope to get there. But it's like, you know, when someone's not engaged, what is the recent type of content they're sending? And then we have some algorithms that'll follow up and try to re-engage users and try to get them to reply. Because that means that they're talking to their health coaches. And in general, that's a positive metric that you're interacting with your health coach. Anyway, so we have that metric on our own internal dashboard. You were asking me about where I was seeing that and why.
Yeah. So that's cool. Is like, I think it's important And I'll stop myself before I get on my soapbox, but I think it's important to be like aware of like what the product is that you're building and what problems you're actually solving, because mm-hmm. then you can actually catch bugs too. So that's sort of how this is related, because like if you see that your conversion rates on something are dropping, maybe it's because there's like a bug, which is actually what it ended up being, which is very, very interesting to think about. Unrelated to that, slightly unrelated to that, is I think it's interesting because we use something called Amplitude. And we have a bunch of like methods that we wrote that help us track things. So like if we want to send something to Amplitude, we can pass in. I think we have stuff for like JavaScript and for Ruby. But like if some event happens, we can pass in a hash or an object or whatever it is. And this is like the first company I've been in where we actually did stuff where we cared about, you know, metrics, which is like, I don't know, very, very important. But the first time you jump into a code base where you see all this code that tracks metrics, you're like, oh, I don't know. It's just like, it's just weird, because when you first become like a developer or whatever, and you think of code, you think of like, I'm writing algorithms, I'm making endpoints, or conversely, I'm writing front end code, I'm writing some React, I'm doing this, I'm interfacing with like external APIs. But like, let's say you create a wizard and you want to know where your users are dropping off. If you hop into code that's like tracking these things, you might see the wizard, but you will also see like events that you're firing off to your external services that are like, oh, user made it to this stage, user made it to this stage. That way, when you look at your graphs, you can be like, oh, maybe our wizard's way too long because it has 12 screens and all of our users are dropping off at screen number 4. Like, what are we doing wrong here? Okay, so that's enough of that soapbox. But it is interesting, because like also if you're tracking more than just metrics and you're tracking like, oh, I want to know if a bug happened here, it's like interesting to see that in your code if you're not used to it. Because when you see, I don't know, mostly like tutorials and books you read don't have exception handling in mind or like failure in mind. So starting to see that in code is like, oh, that's weird. Like, what's this? Why do we have this thing in here? It's like almost a mini context shift, because it like is a break from the algorithm. Like you have this algorithm, and then it's like, oh, I need to like explicitly say that if this fails here, send this event off to AppSignal or whatever it is, or BugSnag or Amplitude, whatever external service it is. I don't know. It's just like one of those things that's maybe you're not used to seeing.
Yeah, I think it's totally related to the idea of planning for failure is planning for success and knowing what those metrics are and tracking those metrics. I think it's really, really important. And they're so closely related, because oftentimes it's similar or the same tooling that's tracking and passing along those, whether it's success or failure in the application, and whether or not that is technical code success or failure, like, or whether it's, you know, something that's more of a business perspective that's failure. But yeah, in this case, and I'm happy that as a developer, I had enough like wherewithal in the program and in the client to understand what the success was. And I'm paying enough attention to know if the product is working to be able to see that people aren't responding. Because in reality, I could have been like, hey, coaches, you're doing a shitty job. You need to like up your game and get people to re-engage.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't changed my algorithms and these numbers are dropping. We could have gone weeks without knowing, understanding why the product was dipping in engagement easily. And that would be a double failure on my part. First, for introducing a bug that like doesn't surface itself. But then second, if I wasn't tracking and understanding and caring about the product in that way, it could have gone on who knows how long. Like, and I wonder, and I'm sure that there's probably a startup out there that failed due to some technical reason that they don't understand why, because they never took the time to understand those metrics or handle the errors properly in the software. And something that I'm kind of excited about more and more, it was annoying at first, but when I'm writing like controller tests or even unit tests, I am writing like 8 versions of the same tests more and more. Not 8 maybe, but multiple versions. Because oftentimes before, when I'd write a controller test, let's say a user's controller test, it would just have a create, update, read, destroy action. I would just create the user, I would update the user, I would show the user, and then I would destroy it. And I'd be like, oh, call it a day, I'm out of here. Like, I've tested all the code, and yes, all the code ran, but I wasn't testing failure or thinking about failure. I was always testing for golden path. And it has slowed down development to some degree, but at the same time, like, things are so much more reliable and I'm so much more confident, and there's some user experience that really gets better when you have those smart error handling and how that's being handled, especially when you're dealing with like complex associations of objects. Like in one of my projects, we have this idea of like an applicant and has application data, and the application data has many application details. And there's like all these like interconnected ideas here. And then once you're an applicant and you become a user of the system can carry over some of that data from your application because it sees, oh, this email has an existing application. I'm going to pre-fill your user profile, like that kind of stuff. And there's a lot there that we now use smart error handling to be like, hey, this email isn't found. Have you applied? Like double check. And so you can check to see if you have an existing email to like, because I'm realizing more and more people use like 8 different email addresses. And it becomes kind of a nightmare as a product manager, like in trying to get your head around that and people confused about what email they've used for what. Oh my gosh. And so getting that type of smart error handling can help your users in some of those ways of prompting them and providing some of that feedback. So it's just one of those things of like planning, and this whole book is about writing with failure in mind. So your controllers shouldn't only cover golden path.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about us as developers that only want to handle golden path things, but like ideally your controller tests should also, you know, you should also test like, oh, this is what happens. I'm going to do these things and I should get a 422, or I'm going to do these things and I should get a 500, because if something fails, like all of a sudden you're getting a 500 when you should be getting a 422, like you'll know exactly like, oh, maybe this is like where something went wrong. That's very funny. On a slight tangent of the whole email thing, we had a bug recently because users on open listings have an email address, right? But when they submit an offer, they put in another email address because like we need to send it, I don't know, I forget what the reason is, but like we send it to a different email address, or
you can send it to a different email address.
Yeah, but like when you submit an offer, you need to put in like your email address and like your co-buyer's email address or something like that. Well, that's a long way to say that the user's email address and the email address against the offer can be out of sync. And I think this is intentional. I forget like the real reason why, but we had a user complain because they didn't want like all the feed emails, even though that's like an opt-in feature, I think, or you can opt out very easily and unsubscribe.
Yeah, it's really easy to opt out of those. Yeah,
but they wanted to, so they were using their spam email address, right? But then like for their, because you know we all have our spam email addresses, but like to actually create an offer and go through with it, like we need their like real email address. So they had to put their real email address in. And then they were getting emails regarding like their offer. And then they were like, wait, why am I getting emails to this email? I should only be getting emails to my spam email address. And it's like, well, you're buying a house. There's like important information that needs to be given to you. So I said this was a bug, but it was more of like a weird user communication error thing.
Yeah.
That I thought was kind of funny because like everyone has like 8 different email addresses. I don't know why that is, but it's like a common thing.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm realizing really, really smart companies let you do it. Like GitHub, for example.
Yeah, you just merge them all.
You can just merge them all, and it's really, really nice. And I think to some degree, like, it would be hard to think about that deeply from a security standpoint to make sure it's not just so easy to toss in other emails. And like, because it's just more points of entry too, because you could reset your password from any of those emails. So there's a lot that I think about with that. But you know, again, that's designing software, thinking about all those, what actual users want and what they're actually doing. But also the whole email thing and why people have so many and they're so afraid to put it in. That's why like almost everything that I'm building, I'm just so standardizing around SMS tokens. It's so much easier for users. And I've really had a lot of good luck with it. It seems to be going really well. And I don't think it's good for a very high security purpose, but I think for in general for a web app, I think it's a really, really great approach for a lot of consumer products. That's another tangent. What else in this section of the book really stood out to you, JP?
Yeah, so I think the last thing we should talk about is I promised that there would be action items. So here they are. Basically, when you're responding to a failure, there's this idea that sometimes responding with a nil value is good enough, right? So like, let's say I have an endpoint that returns nil. Whatever is consuming that should handle like, oh, if I see a nil, I need to surface some kind of error, like whether it's like in the UI or it'll probably be in the UI. And so this is like the idea of what Avdi refers to as like a benign value. And so here's a quote. The system might replace an erroneous value with a phony value that it knows to have a benign effect on the rest of the system. When the system's success doesn't depend on the outcome of the method in question, using a benign value may be the right choice. Benign values are also helpful in making code more testable. And so, unfortunately, I don't have any Ruby examples for this, but for my JavaScripters out there, I have definitely used this sort of like concept of benign values in my like React applications. Also Redux, they happen to be Redux applications. So like when you make an API call, there's a chance that it won't succeed, right? So sometimes if you're using like JavaScript's async await feature and you're not using promises, you can actually wrap API calls in like a try catch block, right? So like inside of your try, you are attempting to make an API request. And if that fails, you're gonna land in your catch block. And so sometimes what I do is I'll format my responses to be like the same, to have the same format, right? So like if it succeeds inside of my try, I'm sending back an object to my front end that is like inside of an object where it's like data and maybe it's like message, right? But if it fails, then I just like pass in like an error message, right? So like, but my friend will be able to handle that. So it will, right, like, first it will see like, if are there any errors in this object that's getting passed back? If there are, surface those and like display that nicely to the user and don't persist anything. And if you're doing some sort of like optimistic loading, like undo that change and like surface like a red banner at the top that says like whatever the error message is that you passed in. Or even if you're just sending a benign value back as nil, just, you know, surface like a generic message that says like, hey, something went wrong. But if something does succeed, then you just have like, you can rely on that same data structure of this object you're passing back to your friend, and that will just like look at the data array or whatever it is and like display whatever data it is that you're fetching. So I thought that was kind of cool, like a kind of a cool way to respond to failure is like keep the same data structure, and that way you can just like pick off the, you know, the keys and the values that you need and display things accordingly.
Yeah, absolutely. What's funny is you describing that makes me realize how much Ruby does this inherently. At least Rails does this inherently. I don't know if it's a Ruby feature or a Rails feature. Those lines are a little blurred in my brain, unfortunately. But to where you can have an object.errors and then augment that object with its errors. So, you know, in the Rails best practices, when you pass, let's say, a new user record to the database and it's validating for existing, it's going to pass that same exact object back into your view, but augment it with errors.
Yep.
And that's really interesting for you to describe it that way, because I've never put that together. Also, didn't get it in the section what it meant by benign values. And then it means, in a way, pass the same value back, when the same structure back, at least, and then handle it in your view. That way, no matter what the error is on the value, it can display it. And I think that's kind of what they're getting to, is whatever error happens, at least something's going to pass to your view that makes sense to the rest of your code to be able to handle that error.
Yeah, so it's like, don't let your whole app explode and show like the GitHub equivalent of like the unicorn or like the octocat that's like fallen in like the river thing that's like 400 or whatever it is. Or no, it's not 400, but 500 or 422 or whatever, unprocessable identity. But yeah, so just surface errors in a good way so that like the app is it's broken, but it's like not completely broken. That was a terrible way describing it, but like... to make it seem that your app's not actually like broken.
Yeah, totally. And I think too, in the same vein, is thinking about this stuff, like we were talking about in tests and things, helps with your user experience design overall, because you're thinking about like what could go wrong. So you're going to have better prompts, you're going to have required flags, like things like that, that are going to make that make a lot more sense. You know, there's so many of these, especially when signing up for something that don't tell you the password requirements, and then you go to put it in and it fails. And it's like, I filled out like 8 fields and you didn't tell me you needed a number, special character, and, you know, the name of a Ninja Turtle when I was putting in the password. And now like it's blowing up at me. And so it's like, I have to re-enter all the data. And now, so it's like, and that kind of goes perfectly into my pick for the week, which I'm so excited to share. And I can't believe I haven't picked this pick. There's a website called useronboard.com.
Okay.
And it's just this one UI designer. And it's funny because it's an ugly website, in my personal opinion. Useronboard.com. It's one UI designer who thoroughly does teardowns of onboarding. And it's awesome. So basically, like, his most recent one was Apple Music. So he literally has screenshot by screenshot with comments of onboarding to Apple Music. And so what it's like as a user, what you see, and there's so many good tips and tricks and like people doing it badly and people doing it amazing that walk you through these different things.
That's so
really
cool.
Really amazing resource. It reminds me of that Patterns website, PTTRNS. Mm-hmm. But this guy just does this out of the goodness of his heart and his own kind of research. And he has just such good insights on tearing these things apart, like page by page. And there's a lot of related ideas in this pick because there's a lot of things like error messages and validation messages, specifically around validations during an onboarding, as you can imagine, that he experiences. But even still, in probably half these examples, he'll experience some kind of error that is like, it just says like, undefined method 405952, like in like big products, like yeah. In like Tidal or Trello, like he experiences these things and he'll just kind of like put in a comment like WTF LOL. Like, cause like we experience these things every day and users do, and they just totally ignore error handling when it's poorly done and just get frustrated. And there's totally examples of that in some of these teardowns, but he's got, how many you think are on there? Probably 35, 40. Of just detailed onboardings. And I like that he doesn't discriminate to just the sexy apps. Like there's mm-hmm. some in here that are just like very odd and like, wow, okay, you went through that. Like, and surprising ones too, like Mailbox for Map or the musiccall.ly app. It's like that kind of like just silly app, but there's so much to take away from so many of these things. Yeah, really, really strongly recommend checking this out and follow this guy. His name's Samuel something. He has a lot of great stuff on Twitter he shares. I'll link both his, you know, his Twitter and the site for sure.
Yeah, that's really cool. Even Basecamp's on there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Okay, so I actually have two picks this week that are both CSS related. Talking about CSS bugs is a whole different story. But my first pick is this website called singlediv.com. And I don't know if you've seen it, but it's this really crazy thing where people make like CSS art. Like the first thing on there is like a pen that was drawn with just CSS. It's insane. People do like the craziest CSS art.
Oh, got it.
It's amazing.
Such a slow page.
Yeah,
that makes sense with what you see that's on here. Wow, this is very impressive, and it's all just a single div.
Yeah. Oh, that's the thing. Wow. It's like a single div with. I'm sure.
I'm seeing it. Like I'm in the inspector. That's crazy.
I bet it's just a bunch of before and after, like
it's literally elements. Just a bunch of before and after, and you can inspect the code here. Oh my God, it's literally using like background elements. And then, okay, so let me describe what I'm seeing here. There is like a pretty photorealistic pen. Then there is like skunks, donuts, cast of Star Wars characters, Pixar characters, and like pretty pixel perfect with gradients and shadows and lights and. This is incredible. I've seen one or two of these. Like there was someone who did the Mona Lisa in CSS, yeah. But this is like a really cool collection of them. This is awesome. Very
yeah,
cool.
I've seen some like photorealistic stuff where it was like even the strands of hair were like pixel mm-hmm. perfect. And
it's
I was
insane.
Like, how do you have the time to do that? I don't even know how to justify an element in the center of a page. No, I'm kidding. Okay. But my second pick is also CSS related. And, you know, as like a developer who mostly touches Ruby and JavaScript, sometimes CSS is like an afterthought, and I always find myself saying things to myself like, I fucking hate CSS. Like, I don't want to waste my time doing that stuff. But because I find myself doing that so often, I'd realize like, hey, maybe this is something I actually need to get like better at. So classic JP move, I bought this book called the Definitive Guide for CSS.
Damn.
It's like a Harry
Holy
Potter book.
Holy hell.
Look at this. Look
it's such a big book. Oh my God.
Yeah, so this is my nightly reading. Just before
well,
I go to
sleep. Well, that'll put you to sleep. Yeah.
Yeah, it really will. It's
why
like,
is there fish on the cover? What is with animals and programming books? What is this?
I have no idea. Visual presentation for the web. Anyways, it's like just one of those things where I'm like, I need to get better at this. I need to like understand how CSS works better than I do instead of like hacking things together and like, you know, fiddling with stuff until it works, like actually doing CSS with like a purpose. So I've been trying to get better at like just reading a couple pages here and there. And I feel like
are you getting good tips from it though? Like, has it been a good experience? Like, is the book pick worthy or are you just kind of saying what you're doing? That's,
oh,
that's,
no.
That's my question.
Sure. Yeah. I've only gotten through like, I don't know, 20 pages.
Okay.
And there was a section on like, how you can select multiple elements based on like how you, it's very hard to describe CSS, but like, you know how you can, there's like a child selector, right? So like if I have a UL and I have LIs, I could do like UL and then I could do like the greater than symbol LI, and that selects children.
Yep.
But yes, there's also a way to select elements where you like space them. So like if I did like div space P space span space, right? Without any like child selectors or without any like dots or anything, like that is like a way to select a span inside of a P inside of a div.
That which, specific one. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like any, or any spans inside of P's inside of.
Yes. And that's more accurate. Any yeah. of that type of nesting.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, did not know that.
Yeah.
That's very that's embarrassing. Funny.
Yeah, well, also with that, like an example, a lot of times I would just go write a class, but it's like, do you really need another class to handle that? You could just select it by its structure, maybe. That's funny. I bet there's a lot in vanilla CSS that I pick up SAS for, because I use SAS really, really heavily, and I bet there's just a lot that I could just be writing CSS. That's interesting. Well, good pick.
Yeah.
It's always good to go back to the basics.
Back to the basics. There's definitely been times where I was like, ooh, this would be some fun trivia. I should send this to John and see what he thinks, like, like, is this going to have a blue border or is this going to have a green border? Like, based on
like what it would look like? Oh, that'd be a fun little project to do.
Yeah, because I'm like, there's definitely times where it's like, oh, this would be very
CSS
useful.
CSS flashcards would be fun, where it's like, you see what the code is and you kind of think to yourself what it would look like. And then you, you know, click view and then you see it.
Oh, dude, that'd be really cool. Yeah,
yeah,
that's
be
like
fun.
A side project for later, right?
Yeah, how many do we need? How many side projects? Well, cool. Actually, we have got a new thing. If you made it this far in the podcast, that means you're probably a quasi fan, and we really, really appreciate you listening. If you're looking to support the show, we actually have a new website that's iteration.tools. Got a fancy new URL. And so it's different from our iterationpodcast.com link. So iteration.tools. And you'll see there a collection of tools that we like constantly message and talk about, and a couple others on there. And so, full disclosure, as much as possible, we're going to be using affiliate links in these, but these are things that we obviously talk about and know and use, at least I do. JP's going to add a couple picks on there. And so, for example, I put on there AppSignal. I'm a heavy AppSignal user. If you sign up, it'll start working toward to get me free credit. And so that would be amazing if I could get my AppSignal account for free and you guys get $100 credit too. So it's a total win-win. It's a product that I already love and you guys can go and join it. And it's like, you know, it's not necessarily money in my pocket, but hey, money saved is money earned and those types of things. And you know, another example is Sticker Mule is on there, and that's a great place to get stickers printed, whether it be for your startup or your meetup or whatever that looks like. And you get a $10 credit, but we get a $10 credit to go towards printing you guys the next round of stickers when we do iteration podcast stickers. And then all the way on the bottom, there is a donate link. But you know, if you really love us, send us $5. That'd be awesome. And thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. And we'll see you guys next week.
All right. Thank you guys so much.